Les colloques du Collège de France.
Right, so thank you for making it all the way here and staying awake for another hour, possibly. Before I start, I just wanted to thank Meryl and Francois and everyone who's been involved in organizing this and sharing sessions. So will you join me in thanking them? I think we can all agree that at least up until now, it's been a great conference. And leave open the rest. Okay, I also want to apologize to Neely and anyone who follows video games. When I came up with this title, I simply wasn't thinking about video games, and so it has nothing to do with that, okay, for those who might be disappointed. Okay, so here's what I want to do. I'm going to try to give a little like relatively intuitive characterization of borderline cases, that is, cases that are said to be borderline fictions, borderline non-fictions. That is the border I'll be concerned with. And then I want to talk about how a few theories of fiction, including my own, would look at these kinds of cases. And finally, the implications of kind of changing my own view in a way to accommodate a certain kind of pluralism. All right, so that's a bit vague. It'll become clear, I certainly hope. Okay, so what are some borderline cases? The standard sorts of examples, so these come up in philosophy, they come up, but they also come up in other places, right? Are works like, for example, religious texts. So a lot of people kind of talk about religious texts, particularly from religions that are no longer practiced, as kind of in between somehow, and even more so with mythologies. I read the Greek myths in my literature course in high school, right? And you don't really study it as a belief system, you study it as a bunch of stories, right? Often histories from earlier eras, which either, for example, like Geoffrey de Montfort's, it's a history of Britain, which is where the story of Arthur and the Round Table come from, right? It's like so far-fetched in this, in very many ways, that it's really not treated as a reliable history. Philosophers often think. Other philosophers often think that Tacitus and Thucydides and the like are also somewhere in between because things that they said were made up, as was conventional at the time. New journalistic works start not only in Cold Blood, but in Cold Blood becomes now what's known as creative nonfiction, and there's a big debate about those kinds of cases, and as we'll see on a lot of theories, that is very much a borderline case. And I'd say certain works of literature that people find a bit puzzling, War and Peace is a standard example. Moby Dick is also a standard example, but that one is trickier because the whole thing is narrated by a fictional character, so in some ways, it's not so... I mean, he just is incredibly boring, but he is a fictional character, whereas War and Peace, there are, you know, entire chapters that are clearly giving Tolstoy's view of history, look more like essays and arguments, and so you might think that's also a kind of borderline case. Now, one thing to note about these cases is that they're all works. So the concept of borderline cases applies in the first instance to works, which it will often be said, right, mix fiction and nonfiction, right, or mix fiction and fact. So it's not the case that, I mean, you can make this case, but I won't consider it. And the intuitive notion of borderline cases, it's not a question about like an individual sentence is a borderline between fiction and nonfiction, right? It's a work that somehow mixes sentences that belong in one side or the other, something like that. Now, borderline cases seem to arise, or at least this might be a first pass at trying to describe what a borderline case is. I'm going to question this, right? Because it seems like you have a work and it sort of contains equal amounts of fiction and nonfiction, or equal degrees of fictionality and nonfictionality, or something of that kind, right? Which, you know, as you can tell from what I just said, seems to be a question of degree. And this is the part that will bore you guys to talk amongst yourselves. You've heard this one. Right? And of course, then we can ask a question, which is like, what does that mean, degrees of fictionality, right? In what sense are there degrees? And what kind of properties are these that are supposed to be properties that come in degrees? And so I want to kind of consider that for a moment, right? One sense in which fictionality could come in degrees is to say that there's more of the content, so a quantitative conception, more of the content is fictional, right? And Curry discusses this. He rejects an attempt to define the fictionality of a work in terms of the number of what he calls fictional statements. And he says we could define a numerical degree of fictionality, but it would be artificial and unilluminating. Right. What he wants to give is a precise account of the fictionality of statements, because the fictionality of works is going to depend upon the fictionality of the statements they contain. So Curry assumes that the work's fictionality depends in some way on the fictionality of the statements. And although he toys with this kind of numerical way of trying to spell that out, he kind of rejects it as difficult. Kathleen Stock, in earlier work, before she wrote her book, had also talked about like number of fictive utterances as a measure of fictionality. It was very difficult to get that to work. So there might be a different sense if it's in degrees, right? It could be qualitative. So it's not that there are more, say, sentences about made up stuff, or however you want to think about it, right? It's rather that it's farther from reality. So there might be some sense in which you want to say that I think these are in some ways equally, but you might think the Metamorphosis is somehow more fictional than Bleak House, even though each of them has an impossibility. I mean, one is a metaphysical impossibility and the other is a physical possibility nonetheless, right? But you can come up with any examples you want, some very realist novel, versus a sci-fi fantasy. There's some sense in which a sci-fi is like more fictional, right? So that's, if you want to think about it in degrees, those are ways of thinking about it. But of course, the next question then is degrees of what? Right? What do you mean when you say degrees of fictionality, if indeed you say that? Well, it could be amount of truths versus amount of falsities, but of course that's like a bit problematic. You know, Out of Shadows is a documentary, a polemical documentary about how the Democrats in the US have a pedophile ring. Yeah, so and had children in this pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. Anyway, so that is like totally false. The documentary is very, very much false, and arguably contains a greater number and a much more distanced conception of what's going on in the world than Germinal, for example, right? I mean, pound for pound, Germinal is going to contain more truths, right? So, okay, truth and falsity doesn't look right. I mean, most philosophers already don't think that's relevant to whether something is fiction. Is it more or fewer signposts of fictionality? So that's a term from Dorit Cohn. It usually refers to free indirect discourse, basically, as a kind of signpost, like the kind of textual features that make you think you're reading fiction instead of reading nonfiction. But again, most philosophers don't think of that as making a difference, although people will say, if they're reading something, a nonfiction that has a lot of free and direct discourse, like Simon Schama's Histories, that there's a kind of fictionalization going on there. You hear that term quite a bit. So this might be what people have in mind sometimes. Reference to non-existence. That's just not going to help with the distinction between fiction and nonfiction. However, you might think a work is sort of more fictional to the extent that it's about more things that are made up, as opposed to things that actually exist and events that actually happened, right? But of course, it's not going to give you like a clear-cut distinction. The ideal gas law, right, refers to nothing, but is not a fiction in the relevant sense. Sometimes I think people just mean something like realistic or unrealistic, which, you know, only really comfortably applies within the domain of fiction in the first place, and so really can't reflect what it can be. Direct informational relevance is how Richard Walsh kind of thinks a bit about this. One of my favorite little books is F in Exams. And there's like a series. So these are actual exam answers by students that received fails. And they're very funny, right? And I take it that nobody reads F in Exams for the information therein contained. Like, they don't read it because they really want to know what kinds of answers have gotten Fs. They read it because it's very funny, right? So the purpose is not to get information. The purpose, right? The purpose is for entertainment. You might think fiction, nonfiction somehow divide in those ways. I think all of these ways of thinking are sometimes involved in cases where people say something is borderline, right? Without really clearly distinguishing all these features. Now, of course, within philosophy, it's a kind of different sort of conception. The usual conception is to adopt some kind of fictive utterance theory, usually, no, not always, applied to parts of works, right? And so the difference between fiction and nonfiction on these views is that fiction invites imagining and nonfiction invites belief, and then there are some further criteria depending on the specifics of the view, but it's not going to matter for present purposes. Probably everyone in this room has heard me go on and on and on about why I don't agree with this theory, so I won't get into it. But the idea is that some borderline cases are sort of very balanced patchworks of these different kinds of parts, right? That's the idea. So they might be works where they're somehow in the middle, right? And I'm just imagining this way of thinking about the degrees, right? So you have this, right, you have 100% fictive utterance. Like, there's nothing, I mean, however one defines fictive utterance, the whole thing is just fictive utterances. Like, think of fairy tales, are probably all fictive utterances, right? And 100% assertions. If you come across such a text, let me know. I'm not convinced it exists. Okay, somewhere, you know, realist fictional narratives will have, you know, it won't be all the way at the end. They'll probably have some other kinds of utterances in there, in my view. And maybe popular history and memoirs will be a little bit further along on the continuum. And then you've got the borderland area in the middle where you have a mix of fictive utterance and assertion. I don't know, maybe social media goes there, fake news, as well as borderline cases of fiction and nonfiction, depending on a person's view. This is, of course, in the most kind of simple way of laying this out. There are other far more sophisticated versions of the view. And I think this whole thing raises a lot of issues about how exactly to understand the kind of border zone between these kinds of cases, right? I just think it's an open question. But it seems to be, at least according to a few people, so notably explicitly Greg Curry and Kathleen Stock, that a number of the works that I mentioned earlier will count as borderline because they invite a mix of imagining and believing. So they consider In Cold Blood to be a borderline case. Curry is sort of waffled about Tacitus. There's a long story there. But in any case, those kinds of cases look like borderlines on their views, and they explicitly say so. Now, I don't think there are such necessary or sufficient conditions for fictionality. And again, I mean, I'm not going to go through my theory, which people have heard about, because that isn't actually my goal today. Okay. But you'll need to know this in order to see what I want to change. So I say fiction and nonfiction are genres. They're like categories of art in Walton's sense. And on this view, they meet the following two conditions. So they're classified by a set of non-essential criteria. I'll talk about those in a moment. And this classification matters to the way you're supposed to appreciate the work. So if a work meets a bunch of criteria that I'll say, and counting it as fiction matters to the appreciation of the work, it's going to be fiction. That's the idea. Okay. So on this approach, and indeed on other possible approaches, so not just my approach, but for obvious reasons, it's easier for me to talk about the one I know. Classification as fiction or nonfiction is multidimensional, so you will not get a continuum along a single dimension, right? Or even along a couple of dimensions, right? You will get, I actually looked up how to map these kind of things and it was too complicated, so. Okay, it's multidimensional. Someone else could do it. And so I claim that one aspect of classification relies on standard features. So, Enrico mentioned this when he was giving his talk, right? So features standard for fiction or for a particular subgenre of fiction would include talking about what doesn't exist, talking about events that never happened, inviting us to imagine in various ways and so on, right? And nonfiction, or say a particular genre like a history, will relate certain real events. We'll talk about people and things that existed, and so on, right? And this is not to say that there can't be features that break these rules. That's totally fine. That's part of what's really interesting about genre change. But only some of these features themselves will be matters of degree. Now, if they're all matters of degree, it won't matter. You take a bunch of things that are a matter of degree, and you might get a very clear verdict, right? As long as they're enough and they're high enough on the various dimensions. But for example, you know, on the dimension of reference to real individuals, Hilary Mantel's trilogy includes no reference to any non-existent individuals. So the whole thing is about real individuals. Not entirely about real events, right? And not entirely about real thoughts of the individuals in question, but on reference, on that one, she's like as far over as you can get, way beyond like every scientific model in terms of just purely in terms of reference, right? But in other dimensions, she will, obviously having made things up, going into the minds of Thomas Cromwell in particular, and so on and so forth, right? That's gonna be some standard features of fiction. Okay. But in addition, so as I said, even if all the standard features were matters of degree, that isn't enough for classification. And the reason it's not enough for classification is that there are many works that break the rules, sometimes with the effect of being challenging, and in other cases, with the effect of creating whole new subgenres, right? So, you know, Tacitus's Annals and Histories contain things that are made up because that's how Roman histories were written. You made up battle descriptions, you made up speeches, right? Truman Capote invents a new genre. In Cold Blood is, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, the first nonfiction novel. There's an entry for nonfiction novel, and this is it. No, there are more since then. But the thought here, and here I'm following Walton's account in Categories of Art, is that part of what determines whether a work counts as fiction or nonfiction concerns facts about the originating context in which the work was produced. So in particular, the author's intention, not any intention, and not the intention to invite belief or imagining, but the intention concerning classification. So Tacitus intended the work to be a history, right? Not only that, he conformed to all the contemporary practices, so his contemporary readers would have had no difficulty at all with thinking it was a history. Okay. In Truman Capote's case, of course, this is, as it were, the first nonfiction novel, but how do we know it got taken up? We know what Capote's intention was because he's been interviewed by George Plimpton for the Paris Review explaining what he was doing, but the key thing that made this take off was the New Yorker's decision to publish excerpts in the nonfiction section of the New Yorker. And that is kind of what gave it the kind of nonfiction authority that Capote wanted it to have, because that was his goal, to create a literary genre of nonfiction. Okay. And I will say, so in these cases, given the intentions, the practices, and so on, these are not borderline on my view, right? So there's a difference between my view and views that think of, however they spell it out, fictionality is something you can have more and less of in a work. Of course, you can have more and less of any of the features I described. And if you wish to call them more or less fictionality, I won't stop you. However, the works themselves are not at all borderline, in my view, okay? Because they're squarely, in this case, two works of nonfiction, given what we know about how they were produced. So the upshot, as I've kind of just indicated, is that compared to other approaches, and possibly, and this could be a drawback of the theory, depending on your intuitions, possibly also contrary to a lot of people's intuitions about what are borderline cases, maybe, right? There are just not very many borderline cases on this theory. And this is especially true when we take into account these contextual features about the origins of the works, because it might be you don't know what to say about a work when you just look at it and you see various, but once you find out, like, oh, well, this is a Roman history and this is normal for Roman history, you know, that's the end of the borderline problem, okay, on this view, right? And also on this view, even kind of complicated cases are not what I would describe as in the middle, in some middle zone, but they can be. They are tend to be cases that could be understood equally well in more than one way. So, give an example, which I've given before. So, Shakespeare's history plays, which, as you may know, were not called the history plays by Shakespeare. They were later collected together as the history plays. At the time, or at least from what I understand, they would have been viewed as a genre of what's called historical poesy. And consequently, given features of that genre, are probably equally well read either as fiction or as nonfiction. So the sources are clear, right? And the distortions are also clear. And the other thing is that the purpose was not, as it were, solely for entertainment. Right? Shakespeare was also a Tudor propagandist. And so this is spreading the Tudor version of history to the masses as well. Okay, so it's arguable that in some ways it functions as popular history in much the same way as the mystery plays and morality plays of the medieval period functioned as kind of popular religion. Right. Okay. Now, I think this idea that you can think about them in either way, where without them being a kind of mushy, mixy thing, that's my technical term, that just follows from the nature of genres. Jane Austen's kind of the classic example of this. So Austen's novels are both romance and realism. So she's considered an early realist and a late romance writer. And the books clearly have both, but you can read Austen through the lens of what she's telling you about society at the time, and you can also, and most movies seem to only care about the romance part of what's going on in Austen, but you're missing quite a bit if that's all you care about. Okay. Now, I have taken for granted in what I've written about this and so far in this talk following Walton that correct categorization relies in part on facts about the originating context. But arguably, this is too constraining. After all, with respect to genre, right? Some genre categorizations are adopted retrospectively, okay, suggesting a role for the context of reception, which is similar to something that Enrico said yesterday about artifacts where, you know, the function can change. It may not be just what it was intended to be when it was first made, or may not no longer be used for what it was originally made for. Okay. And similarly, there are, of course, genres where that is the case. So this is an image, a painting of Tintern Abbey. So, you know, William Wordsworth is widely considered a romantic poet, but was not called a romantic poet at the time. So that grouping, I mean, I remember when I'm studying these guys and I just thought, I do not see how Byron and Wordsworth are meant to be the same thing. I mean, it was explained, but it was pretty clear to me there was some arbitrariness in this grouping. It, you know, largely having to do with how mopey the poets were, less to do with how they wrote. But in any case, so that's a retrospective classification. Similarly, if you look up conceptual art, you will find Duchamp's Fountain in every discussion of conceptual art, even though the official genre of conceptual art develops in the 1960s with a group of artists like Joseph Kosuth, who called what they were doing conceptual art and so on. But the ready-mades have been, for fairly obvious reasons, taken up into the domain and thought of as, you know, early conceptual art. So why not say the same for fiction? Why assume that whether a work is fiction is a question only about the originating context, right? Okay. So I want to just say, recognizing a role for the reception context, and I'm going to say something about what role it plays in a moment, is more consistent with critical pluralism in the sense that I've defended it. So, like, this is so awkward. According to me, for many works of literature, there are at least, and we can expand this beyond literature, it's just easier for me to talk about it this way, there are at least two equally good interpretations of a work. One, which is a historicist interpretation, that is an interpretation that is constrained by the context in which the work was produced. And that's an interpretation that generally cares about the history of production. It does genetic criticism. It denies the genetic fallacy of Wimsatt and Beardsley. And it asks the question, why is the work the way it is? Why was it constructed this way, right? Why are there all these references to this in such and such work? So I've written about this with respect to Hamlet, and basically if you don't engage in this kind of interpretation, you can't understand various kinds of symbolism which would have been transparent to Shakespeare's contemporaries, but which is not transparent to us anymore. But if you want to understand why, you know, Shakespeare has Hamlet looking at the skull and why, and talk about the earth, right? It really helps to know a lot about the four humors. And so a lot of that is missing if you don't engage with this question. Why is the work the way it is, which I think is clearly an important question for interpretation and requires looking at the originating context. But I think there are also interpretations that I call non-historicist, for want of a better term, that aim to answer the question, how does the work relate to reflect the real world, the world that we're in? And this is a question where I want to say what we're concerned about is not so much how Shakespeare thought things were, but how things really are. So in the case of Hamlet, this is the interpretation that says, I don't care if Shakespeare thought that Hamlet had an excess of black bile. I'm going to assume that Hamlet was psychologically like human beings, and I'm going to interpret his actions in that way. Right, so people are like constantly trying to figure out like why is Laertes so peeved? I mean, of course, he's peeved because Hamlet has killed his father. Spoiler, sorry. But he's just unusually aggressive and unwilling to listen to reason. And the answer for Elizabethans is because he's choleric. He has too much color in his body. I mean, it's very straightforward. It's stated in the play. But if you think there's something maybe a little bit disappointing about that explanation because you think that these are kind of very plausible characters psychologically, then you probably think that they have the psychology that people do, and that's why this play is somehow perennial, right, and can be performed all over different cultures, different countries, and have meaning to people over so much time. Okay. And I think that a good kind of case in point as well, so Hamlet's the case I've made, but Jane Eyre, you know, there's no historicist interpretation according to which this is like a post-colonial novel, right? Or an interrogation of the colonial situation. But there are very good and fascinating ways of reading Jane Eyre where that, when you think about it, that way you discover quite a bit of interesting material. And you start to seriously doubt, as you should, Rochester, or that the ending is remotely happy. Right? So all of those things are consistent with the text. It's in there, references to Jamaica and the colonies, and all of that is already in the text. It's not like making stuff up. It's just highlighting aspects of the work that wouldn't have been really thought about so much by Charlotte Bronte herself. So the point is that I'm already committed to the view that when we're thinking about interpretation, we should not necessarily only be restricted by what is about the origins of the work. And so I ought to think, perhaps as well, with classification, that we shouldn't always be restricted by the origins of the work. And I think that's right, and I have resisted, I've thought about this for a long time, but I've resisted incorporating it because it just makes things messy. So, which is not a really good philosophically deep explanation. But what happens if we go messy? So the genre theory itself is compatible with recognizing a role for the context of reception because that's just another kind of categorical feature, right? How do we treat it? How do we classify it is obviously a contextual question that we can ask. And so on this, a kind of, let's call it a mashup for fun, in addition to the author's classificatory intentions and facts about the practices of classification contemporary with the author, right, we can also consider our current practices. Right, so, you know, the way that people read the Greek myths now strongly suggest that we categorize them as a kind of fiction, right? They don't get taught in your religious education courses, they get taught in your literature courses, right? There's a lot of reasons to think that that's how it's taught, and at least in many cases, and I realize calling the Bible fiction, something I've thought a lot about, religious texts and the relation to fiction and nonfiction, calling the Bible fiction is much more incendiary than calling it literature because it is literature. But it's implicit in the idea that we can study the Bible as literature that it can be thought of not in its primary functional way, that people, you know, who don't believe it can also study it equally. And so these are kind of cases which look really obviously ready for this kind of treatment, that, right? Now, these are cases where they won't line up. I mean, many cases the verdicts do line up, right? So, I don't know. I mean, trying to think of an obvious example. Let's say Daniel Defoe novels were fiction then, and they're fiction now, and there's not any controversy. It all lines up. That's easy. But in these other cases, it might conflict, right? So does that mean that when we update the genre theory in this way, we now get a bunch more borderline cases than we had before, right? It raises that question. And I mean, again, I think these are not borderline cases in the sense of somehow being in the middle or being in between the categories. I think that these are cases that can be read either way, like fully either way, with commitment, right, in each case. So there are just good reasons to read them in one way or the other, in parallel with differing motivations for interpretation, or perhaps like Turn of the Screw, to read in both ways at once. This is not technically possible, in my view, but certainly if you've read Turn of the Screw when aware of the two conflicting interpretations. Are people familiar with Turn of the Screw? There are a lot of nods. Okay, you can ask me if that's the best way to read it. It's the most fun way to read it, being aware of the two interpretations. But what you're kind of doing is toggling back and forth and sort of thinking, well, if it's like this, then so at a meta level, you're thinking about both, but you're toggling back and forth between the two. And I think there are a lot of interesting consequences for appreciation, right? So a lot of the discussion in philosophy because of the kind of most people who are fictive utterance theorists are Griceans, not Manolo, but others, so it's very much an intention-based account. And so there's like a very strong criticism of Walton, that Walton fails to distinguish between works that are fiction and works that are treated as fiction, because if the work was intended to be fiction or nonfiction on those views, well, intended in one way or another on those views, that's just the way it is, and everything else is treated as, right? If we open up the genre theory in this way, which I haven't got any philosophical reasons to think we shouldn't, frankly, although I'd love to hear some, because that'll make my life easier, I think that we're not going to make that dodge. There's not going to be this distinction between treating something as fiction as being fiction. It's going to be fiction according to a certain interpretive approach, nonfiction according to a different approach, right? And that may have really interesting implications for how we appreciate those works in kind of the way that knowing these two different possible interpretations, which are really genre classifications of Turn of the Screw, right, have consequences for how we appreciate the work. And that's it.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.